Hello and welcome to Blowing Cartridges, the gaming podcast where we dive into the issues surrounding gaming culture and the games themselves. I'm Brendan Tam, and joining me as always is my good friend and co-host Zach Clark. And Zach, so I guess we had a bit of a resolution for 2024 that in the, I think what is the fourth year of our podcast, that we would get more guests on, new voices, and really elevate Blowing Cartridges and keep on bringing things new to our audience, whoever our audience may be. We know some of those people. Some of those people remain faceless to us, and that's part of the whole fun of having an online podcast. So, Zach, why don't you introduce who we have on today to talk to us?
Yeah, I mean, one of the challenges of our podcast is we're on different sides of the planet, and, you know, gravity affects us in the same way but differently. So we thought we'd get someone who's had to learn a lot about gravity in recent probably years, I would say. I want to welcome Nick from Turtle Flip Studio. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys. Really exciting to be here.
Yes, and for those who don't know, and what my attempt at a joke there is relating to is Which Way Up, which is a indie game that Nick and his studio is working on, set to launch next year. And we're here to talk all about that, as well as just learn a bit about Nick and the studio and the development process behind it. So, again, thank you for coming on today. And why don't we start with, we're keen to learn a bit about you, your background, you know, how you've gotten into this, you know, development of this, what seems to be a brand new studio and its first game.
Yeah, no, happy to talk about it. I guess the game itself, Which Way Up, was really inspired just from a prototype I decided to build. I might be jumping ahead a little bit, but there's this YouTuber called Jasper, who kind of does game dev explorations about how games are made, maybe the technology or the techniques used behind them. And they did something on how the gravity is kind of designed and coded and created in Super Mario Galaxy. Mario Galaxy is basically one of my favorite games. I have a lot of nostalgia just from not only, you know, the feeling, which is one of the main aspects, which I can definitely come back to, the feeling of controlling the character through worlds of gravity, but it's also just the settings. They're just so imaginative and creative, and I love fantasy and sci-fi, and I think, you know, when you have things set in space, you can kind of do anything. You can go anywhere. I mean, just kind of, I love Rick and Morty as well, and that's a great example of being able to go anywhere and do anything. So, yeah, I've always loved that, but yeah, that inspiration from that video led me to think, oh, you know, I'm not an amazing coder. Like, I'm not, you know, a coder at Nintendo, but maybe I can try to do two-dimensional Super Mario Galaxy prototype and then just see how that goes. And it kind of just turned from figuring out if I could do that into just, you know, step-by-step adding more and more features, testing it, taking it to playtesting events, and it kind of grew from there. And it certainly wasn't meant to be what it is currently. I wanted to make something different when I started off, but it's been a journey to get here, and it's been super exciting.
Yeah, for those who haven't seen the game, I mean, you've demoed it at, you know, PAX and South by Southwest last year, and there's a live demo on Steam if anyone does want to download it, and we highly recommend doing so. The game is sort of like a gravity-based party game collection. Would that be fair to say? Would you go with that term, or have I?
Yeah.
Label it. Okay. Good. Glad to see I can do my genres okay. So you're saying it didn't sort of start out that way. What was your original vision? Was it something more single player focused like Mario Galaxy, or what were you thinking originally?
Yeah, well, I've always loved, I guess, shared experiences in general. So I always wanted it to be a multiplayer game. I kind of knew that. I have a lot of inspirations behind that. But I really wanted it to be a co-op adventure game, basically. And so I started thinking about it that way. But I realized quickly that co-op adventure games actually need quite a bit of content and quite a bit of care. And I guess just it's quite a bit of scope. And it wasn't something that I had time or budget for, or I guess like the energy to do on my own. I mean, I was just doing this as a little fun project at the beginning. And so through just implementing things and thinking about it, I just decided I would strip things back as much as I could and think of a game where I could create multiplayer where I could reuse resources as much as I could so that I could still make something fun, unique, and I guess varied, but I wouldn't have to create heaps of different settings and worlds and environments and story. It's definitely something that I'd love to look into in the future, depending on how this release goes, of course. But yeah, that's kind of how it ended up. It was more of a functional thing.
And how, I guess, in making these decisions, because I guess when you're designing a game, because, and I think as you just briefly outlined, there's steps along the way when you have to make these gameplay design decisions of, well, what the scope's going to be, how the game's going to function, what the overall aim and makeup of the game is ultimately going to be. How did your previous experiences in game development, I guess, help you realize and come to an understanding of, well, what is feasible, what's not feasible? I guess you started out with this idea of a cooperative multiplayer adventure game, and you realized, well, at this point in your development journey, or not even development journey, at this point in what's feasible on your end as a designer working on your own, that's not feasible. I guess what role is your cumulative experience playing in making these decisions, and how important do you think that is?
Yeah. So I would say that a lot of the learning kind of came through, sure, my own experiences. I actually worked on, I released another game under my own name called Ashy Lake of Light. So I'm very much into puzzle games. And I actually designed that game, I suppose, for myself. I was thinking less about marketing and audiences back then. And it was just a game that it was kind of like a passion project. And I designed it as if I was the only player, I suppose. That was a very fun experience. But I learned a lot about, I suppose, thinking about game design from the audience's perspective, the player's perspective, and in terms of how the different types of players that I want to see playing the game. Because I think back then, I really wasn't in that mindset. It was all just about, I really hope people that are like me enjoy playing this game. And that just doesn't necessarily get you as far as you might like. And it's satisfying in a certain personal way, but it's a little bit disheartening when you see people not understanding certain concepts. So making things a little bit easier to understand and relatable is a big part of that kind of experience. I would say another thing that I experienced that I really learned from is just going to these game development meetups in Sydney. So IGDA Sydney hosts these little meetups called Beer and Pixels, which I started going to maybe 5 to 10 years ago. I can't remember exactly, but that was a really big kind of change in my life where I got to start meeting game developers in Sydney. I would go there and playtest other developers' games, give thoughts and feedback to theirs, and then I started taking my own games there and kind of learning about, you know, the importance of taking feedback, communicating ideas to each other, and meeting friends and kind of broadening my network, I suppose. And a lot of those people that I met there have turned into really great friends. And one in particular is the creator of Boomerang Foo, Paul Gopetko is his name. He runs the studio Cranky Watermelon. Yeah, we became really good friends, and I kind of just followed his journey the whole way through. I was a big advocate and supporter of his game, and I just loved playing it and seeing people play it. We would often have little discussions about, you know, game design features, and I ended up being lucky enough to do a few level designs on that game. In the first release, I think I maybe did a third or a little bit more of the level designs, which was really fun for me just to work with Paul. But for sure, that game and seeing that game is just a big inspiration for me, and Paul's decisions that he made creatively, and also just kind of the productivity decisions, I suppose, or maybe the way he chose to design the characters, for instance, is a big part of how I've chosen to design mine, to kind of invite a younger audience, to invite a larger audience. And I think it's a big part of, like, for me at least, kind of bringing people into this movement system that isn't necessarily as intuitive for everyone as I would like it to be. And I think, you know, the cute little characters really kind of draws people in. And even though the movement mechanics can be a little bit difficult for some, I think it can kind of keep people in, because there are all sorts of different ways to keep people playing. Yeah, I think I touched on too many things there, but
I think that's really interesting. I think there's a number of things we can unpack there, and I think going off, we like to be very ablative and go on many tangents here, but going off what you just said, I think playing the demo, and unfortunately I wasn't able to play it with other people since I wasn't able to bully any of my friends over here to come over with some spare controllers and get the local multiplayer working. But I did play around with it over the last couple of days, and I do get that sense of the visuals and the music. You do really build that atmosphere of this is something welcoming and open, and it's not a scary experience, even if the gameplay and the movement, as you mentioned, how the character moves and the physics works, is something a bit unusual to some people. For me, it's not unusual because yes, I've read the marketing, so I know the Mario Galaxy links, and I was looking for those. But at the same time, when I picked up that controller and started moving the characters around, I'm sure Zach will have some thoughts on it as well. But for me personally, you very much feel that physics dynamic, how gravity pulls you to whichever body is closest to you, and how all that works is very much reminiscent to the first time I picked up Mario Galaxy when that first launched, and you start jumping around and you realize how the world works, how momentum works when you're moving around these objects, and it just, and how it all comes together. And even if it's something new and bold and what people haven't experienced, it works for Nintendo. So I think, yes, Nintendo is this large corporation that have many, many developers and designers around it, but I think it's great to see that, well, you're able to also create something with a very simple, in my opinion, with a very similar feel. So I've enjoyed playing around with it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I reckon I'd be curious whether this is intentional or not, but you were sort of talking about how, you know, you want younger players or even maybe less experienced players to find the game quite accessible. Because I played this with my wife and she beat me, so she loved the game because she destroyed me at it. But I reckon one of the things I noticed with the gravity mechanic is because in very few or maybe none of the maps or mini games you can really fall off a ledge compared to, say, if I was playing, I don't know, Super Mario Brothers Wonder or whatever, where it's quite easy to jump and fall off a cliff and feel a bit useless. Was that part of the intentional aspect of making it gravity-based, where you're going to land somewhere, just you might not know exactly where, but you're not going to die so you can keep playing? Or was that more a coincidence that formed out of that original inspiration of making it a gravity-based platformer?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, actually. From my perspective, actually, that question makes me think of the difficulties of being able to kill players, because sometimes I want to design games where it's difficult for people to platform, and generally gravity allows us to kind of push players into zones where they will fall and die. But in our game, yeah, it's very hard for them to do so. And I think the answer to your question is it was more of a coincidence, and a happy coincidence at that. I think it's really nice to just allow players to kind of fail really gracefully. And I think that's part of the learning process that I really love, is that I'm a big advocate of hand-holding as little as possible and tutorializing as little as possible. So I just love it when players can discover things on their own. So I kind of love watching during playtesting moments where people can I can see that it's starting to click, that they understand how the gravity works and how it feels, and how you can start to move a little bit more efficiently if you jump while you're running, or you can attack the gravity at certain angles. And I think that's the nice thing, is that you can platform very easily, from planet to planet, but it's not necessarily that easy to platform the most effectively or efficiently or quickly. So that's something that you can kind of work on and figure out, and I think it can be quite satisfying. And again, I think it was just something that came out. I didn't necessarily plan for all of that, so it's been very fun to just build slowly in that regard.
Awesome. The other, I don't like to make too many comparisons, but I think it is helpful, and you've already brought up one Australian game designer, so I'm going to bring up another one. I definitely reckon the gravity element and how it's a bit like, it's you feel like you've got a degree of control, but it's also a bit uncertain. Gives me massive like Bennett Foddy vibes, like, you know, Quop, or like, not to the same extent. It's not nearly as difficult as Quop, but I can definitely see that element of like, you just feel like, oh, I get what I did wrong, but I also kind of don't get what I did wrong when you make certain jumps. But it's the right sort of balance, I guess, of feeling like you're in control but not quite in control, so you don't feel like it's punishingly difficult.
No, that's another interesting point, actually, because that idea has come up, especially with other game designers who have played the game. I kind of get the feedback a few times, not super regularly, but people will say, have you thought about visualizing gravity somehow? Like letting me know what the gravity curve will be so that I can see like how it's going to fall off, where I need to be, because it feels a bit uncertain when I play. And it's something that I've kind of struggled with a little bit. I've thought, yeah, I wonder how it could be done. Me and the lead artist, Sydney, we've kind of talked about it a fair bit, and we decided that it would kind of add too much visual clutter, and I want to try to keep the world as minimal as possible. Also, the fact that we're creating a bunch of different mini games means that we just have to keep the world as free as possible, just for visual elements to really stand out and communicate what they need to communicate in every different mini game. So I think, you know, some sort of gradient, for instance, it wouldn't necessarily be that to communicate gravity visually would just add a lot over what's already going on. And I also really like just the discovery aspect, again, of kind of figuring out like, oh, why did that happen? Why did I just fall like that? That's weird. And maybe I go back and try again. Or maybe I just have to keep running away from the black hole that's about to kill me. So, yeah.
Curious, so you mentioned before, and I brought it up, and I think you've just mentioned playtesting. Were there any key breakthroughs that you sort of had, particularly maybe even after, like, I might be wrong, but was last year PAX and then South by Southwest, which were almost like back-to-back in terms of timing, which must have been challenging in and of itself. Was that sort of your big debut in getting a large quantity of complete strangers trying out the game? And I guess keen to see what you learned from that process that's maybe fed back into the game as it's now currently standing.
Yeah, South by Southwest and PAX were very close together. you have identified that very accurately, and it was a difficult time.
I can definitely tell the trauma in your voice.
the tricky part was we really wanted to, I guess, get some of the changes that we wanted to make. Sorry. Take some of the learnings we had from PAX and make changes to the game before South by Southwest. I see every playtesting event as like a milestone and an opportunity to playtest. So I really dislike not making changes between events because it's just kind of like a wasted opportunity in my mind. So I'll just be seeing people making the same, not mistakes, but doing things that I don't want them to do, for instance. It was a bit of a rush. But they were very different experiences, PAX and South by Southwest. Both really interesting and really fun. And we got to meet a lot of cool people. So I don't regret going to either of them. But yeah, as for the like other half of the question, I would say that we kind of made a lot more of our big discoveries from playtesting really early on, I think. I think that the bigger ones, like I would say that the game dev is kind of, I could chop it in half. The first half was like figuring out how to make gravity work, not just technically, but more in a user experience kind of way. Like, for instance, the first few tests that I did for a kind of a player controller to get people to intuitively understand how to move around were terrible. Like, they didn't feel fun at all. I was like, this isn't going to work. There were a few times I was like, I should just put this prototype out. It doesn't really feel like it's going to be fun because it's difficult to move around. So, you know, there's this really big core problem, which is like, if I am on one side of a planet, if I want to move down, then I'll hold down on the joystick, then I'll kind of like run around the planet, and then I'll be on the other side. But then down is now up in the context of the player. So what does that all mean, kind of thing? How do I fix that? And so, yeah, that took like, I don't know, maybe 3 months of kind of iterative testing, different little variations, and I kept overcomplicating it, trying kind of this controller mapping that was saying, you know, if the player is still holding this direction, then will keep the player moving in that direction until they let go, and then it resets, and then it will take the next kind of vector of movement. All of those were just too confusing. They made too many assumptions, and I eventually kind of, I think I took inspiration kind of from vehicles in Halo. So if you can think about, vehicle, I like the Warthog and the, I can't remember the other, the alien floating
the Banshee.
They would, you basically just point the camera where you want to go, and the car will just kind of figure out how to get there on its own. And so I thought, well, why don't I just do that? Kind of let the player just point exactly where they need to be, and then the player will just either move left or right on the ground that they're in. That's the first problem, and then that's ground movement, and then air movement is slightly different. But yeah, that was one of the big and interesting design problems, I would say. And then there were a bunch of other ones that came fairly early on. Those were very fun and kind of like informed whether or not we'd keep working on the game after that. One of which actually was, well, actually I was going to bring this up as well. There are these kind of two design pillars that I like to think about when designing a game. One is keeping things extremely simple so that it's very approachable for people to pick up and play. And the other one is just kind of trying to design a high skill ceiling in so that more experienced gamers can actually kind of, well, it's a replayability factor. You can come back and you can learn new things, you can discover new things, or you can keep getting better. So those two things are always at odds with each other. They kind of one goes up and the other one kind of goes down. And trying to keep that simple is difficult. And I think I did a bad job at keeping things simple really early on. So one example of that is at the beginning, I just wanted to keep adding kind of abilities. So I wanted to add a ground pound mechanic, and I did. Mm. We had a ground pound really early on. So you would just jump wherever you were in space. The character would find the closest kind of body in space, and then it would do a ground pound towards it. And then, you know, if there were players around, then maybe you would knock them back. Maybe you would trigger something when you did a ground pound. But it turned into actually a really interesting and fun way to traverse the world or traverse the map, because you could kind of move across really large spaces, yeah, in short lengths of time. I don't know if you remember, there's one mini game which is effectively soccer or Rocket League implemented. Yeah. And I had a special case where the ground pound would always prefer to ground pound into the soccer ball. So if the soccer ball was all the way on the other side of the map and I just did a little jump and did a ground pound, the character would kind of launch all the way over there. And it didn't make any sense balance-wise, but it was incredibly satisfying. So it's like, oh, this is fun, but it doesn't make sense. And it's also another thing to pick up. So we found out through playtesting that a lot of people don't know what a ground pound is. Not everyone's played Banjo-Kazooie, which is just a game that I kind of cherish from my childhood. Or here's some other games, Mario games. Ground pound is kind of just ubiquitous.
I feel like 64 era was peak ground pound. Like everything had a ground pound.
Exactly. And it was obvious to me. It's like, yeah, well, everyone will understand this. But no one, very few people, surprisingly. Like, I suppose more casual gamers will kind of understand that. And so, yeah, I took that out in favor of having just a smaller number of mechanics. And once I came up with this idea of a comet push to be able to interact with the world, I thought that it made a lot of sense, because I thought it would be able to be used in lots of different ways. So a comet push, just to contextualize it, is kind of like a punch, I suppose, or a charged punch, super like Smash Bros, where you might be holding A left and you can charge it up to a certain length of time. If you charge it up for too long, it will just trigger on its own, but you can let it go at any time, and how long you charge for it just affects the power. And a comet push is almost like a little mini using the force kind of thing, and there's a little cone ahead of you. So yeah, I liked that because it kind of meant I could use it in different circumstances. So that's the default behavior, but I also have it sometimes in mini games. If you're holding something and you charge, then you get to throw the thing that you're holding using that same button. But it just means it's one less button to learn for the player, it's one less kind of action. You're still kind of projecting something into the world. Mm. Those two things are always at odds, and it's a big theme in our game design, especially when taking feedback from people. And I get different types of feedback. You know, all the really big gamers, the hardcore gamers that play first-person shooters, when they play the game, they're like, oh, can you... What about a shield? What about a force push cancel? I'll get other, you know, more casual gamers. They're like, can you just make it easier to jump from planet to planet? So I'm like, what do I do?
Okay, note to self, will not ask for wave dashing in the game. One thing that I just thought of, and I could speculate on, but I'd rather you just say it rather than I ramble. You sort of mentioned how certain mechanics came up during development of particular mini games. Was there currently six mini games, if I recall correctly, in the game, or at least in the demo that's available? Was there a sort of an order to which they came about through maybe, I don't know, discovering, oh, I've put in this mechanic, hey, this would make for a cool, again, like, I don't know, the soccer one, or, you know, how this impacts, say, Overload, which is kind of like the more combat-y one of the bunch, you know? Was there a particular order in which they transpired in the development process?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. The first, I think it was the character abilities are definitely inspired more by the order of the minigames. The first minigame that we did, it was the one called Constellation Catch currently. And so for me, I started off just thinking practically or functionally about trying to create uniqueness across the minigames and explore gravity platforming in different ways. And that's kind of our overarching goal. It's like, how can we kind of look through different lenses at this same core mechanic, gameplay feature, something like that. And so, yeah, Constellation Catch is just about platforming well in gravity. So you just have to run around the map and touch these little stars. And once you touch them, you don't collect them yet, but they turn into your color. You've kind of captured them, and that starts a timer. So you have to kind of protect that. And for me, it was kind of like, I kind of related it a little bit to Splatoon, where you're kind of catching as much of the map as you can, but you have it's contested effectively until the timer runs down, and then you have that map, that little star. So that part of the map is yours. So it turned out being quite unique because a certain little emergent properties came out, like people strategized, and I didn't plan for this, but people found that if you just chase someone, like you just follow someone, then they will collect the star, and then you just recollect the star they just collected, and then you just kind of keep running and you keep chasing someone. And so that just came out of the core mechanic. That was really simple. The next mini game that I really got excited about is basically I wanted to make Rocket League in space.
yes.
And so it was all about soccer, the soccer mechanic. How am I going to get the players to hit the ball into the goals? To be honest, it's still one of the trickier mini games. It can be on certain maps pretty difficult to score. To collect these little comets into your own little area. But I still think it's quite satisfying when you can pull it off. So that one I've kind of left in because I love it so much and because it is a more of a high skill ceiling game. And I kind of look at a lot of the mini games that way. Like, yes, it's a bit trickier for some players, but other players will find it quite satisfying. And that also ties into customizing the game. Every time you start, you can turn on and off certain mini games before you start a game. But yeah, like I said, it kind of relates back to Ground Pound. Ground Pound was one of my experiments with the Rocket League game, which is called Comet Collect. Yeah, at first it was just about kind of launching yourself at these balls, almost like a pool shot, where you're trying to aim, angle yourself, and then you just hurtle towards the ball and you give it that kind of speed. And I think I designed it so that the closer you were before the ground pound, the more power you'd give it. So you just have to be as close as possible. And yeah, that was fun. But I realized, I think I was going to start adding more abilities for every mini game. And that's something that I didn't want to do. I didn't want to be creating like a new mini game and saying, okay, now I need to add you know, the X button does this specific thing for this minigame. Because I couldn't really find out after I designed that ground pound. I was starting to design other minigames around a ground pound because I had it, but I couldn't really think of that many other things that worked super well. So yeah, we took out ground pound and now we have the comet push. And I think, yeah, that works a little bit better. It's a bit easier these days. I think we kind of came up until we've designed the player controller in a nice way that we can do a lot of the things we need to do. But yeah, that was an interesting and tricky process.
Awesome. While during the process, you've mentioned a few other names. I'm just keen to understand a bit more about Turtle Flip as a studio. Like how is it structured? Do you have a few people that are on staff, or is it more like you've contracted things out? Just keen to hear a bit of, and also, I mean, I guess, you know, you mentioned before you released Ashy under your own personal name. Was there a key reason you flipped from, and pun was intended there with the word flip, to creating an actual, you know, studio and public, putting a game out under that label?
Releasing Ashy under my own name, I think it was kind of a passion project, and it was a few years ago. I was a bit younger. I really didn't work with that many people. It was mostly just me. So I think it just made sense to release it under my own name. But moving forward, deciding to create a company, it was for a few reasons. There are a few, I guess, practical reasons. It makes sense to operate under a company, which are boring and I won't necessarily go too deeply into,
but yep, they are tax advice from your local accountant, etc.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, one in particular is finding funding, for instance, which is important when you want to work on larger games and working with people as well. But yeah, the team we have is, it's not huge, and I would say it's more we have kind of a bunch of different contractors that work at different times and on different things. I think we have a core team. So our lead artist is Sydney Liao, and they've done the character design, the kind of the world design, and we talk a lot about UI and UX together. Yeah, it's kind of like I talk to Sydney about a lot of aspects. They are extremely important to the project, and their heart and soul has really been imbued into, you know, the cute little characters. And every time we get compliments, especially if Sydney's not there, I make sure to relate them back to them, because it's really not me that makes all these cute little characters attract all the people to play the game. So we have Sydney. There's also Adam, who is the 3D artist. They do the modeling and the animation. And then our composer and sound effects artist is, they have this profile and avatar, I think. Their Memo Demo is what they're called. So you can look them up. Actually, I think they have a really decent following on, you know, SoundCloud and Bandcamp. So I would really encourage anyone to go check them out. I kind of thought that their musical vibe would suit the, I guess, arcadey aspect of the game, and so I got in contact with them, and now they're working on the project, so we're super lucky to have them. But yeah, we work with a few other people here and there, contracting on a shorter term basis, and yeah, no, it's I've really enjoyed, actually it's been a big learning experience for me, going from working like you mentioned on my game on my own, Ashy, to working on this project where I've kind of opened up my mind to, you know, letting other people's ideas be really inform the game, and not kind of just being stuck on my preconceived notions of what a game that I'm making should or need to be. I think that's extremely important. I think it was an extremely important lesson for me to kind of go through or gain and learn. So, I mean, I would encourage any game developers to, or anyone, any budding kind of developers, if you want to make games, I would say try to meet people who also want to make them, do game jams, understand how to communicate. All of those things are so important, I think, and they really make things so much more efficient and faster and kind of, I guess, just more relatable. You have people designing from different perspectives. It means that you're going to get lots of different opinions back. and design feedback and thoughts. And I think it makes the games you make kind of attractive to a wider audience. So yeah, that's been the whole game's a very big learning experience for me. It's been wonderful.
And do you think that your work on Boomerang Foo, which you mentioned earlier, was integral to getting you onto that path from moving from actually working on your own to helping out another designer on their work that, as you mentioned, you met through the game group in Sydney, to then now you're finding yourself managing a team, having to figure out at what point you bring people in, at what point you realize that, well, you can't do everything on your own and you do have to, well, lean on other people's expertise, because you're never going to be able to be an expert on every element of a game as the game grows in scope and what you want it to actually achieve.
Yeah, no, definitely. Paul from Boomerang Foo has actually been a huge mentor to me. He's been a really great friend and kind of advisor. He's so generous with his time and his resources and his advice. Me just watching his development of the game, it has definitely taught me a lot. And I've just been lucky to have him as, like I said, a friend, but also just like someone who I can ask heaps of questions about the process. And I definitely admit that it's no accident that I've made a very similar genre of game to his, because I believe that I kind of am lucky to have him as a friend and to be able to ask him these questions and learn from his experience. So Boomerang Foo is a huge inspiration, and Paul is as well, and I love that game, and it's kind of I kind of felt as though I was benefiting from the experiences from him. I enjoyed watching all the moments, little accomplishments that the game made when it was played by lots of audiences in a certain way. I would kind of, it felt like I was on the team as well, and I was.
Yes.
in a small part, but I was there the whole time, and very lucky to have kind of met Paul, and he's a wonderful person.
Yeah. Not to jump around too much, but going back to one of Zach's earlier questions regarding PAX and South by Southwest, Zach and I was having a conversation last year, actually, when the events were happening. We went to PAX, but we weren't at South by Southwest, and we were wondering, what were the differences in terms of vibe and how the events were, I guess, structured from your perspective as a developer bringing a game to an audience? Because yes, we know they are very different events in their makeup. PAX is very much more of a traditional video game convention, bringing in that particular crowd and audience in. And South by South and West, of course, has the film background and history to the event. So I guess a question on the indulgence of Zach and I's curiosity, but we'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think South by Southwest Sydney is in its infancy. This was the first year that they have had the event in Sydney. And I believe they had a lot to live up to, bringing it over here. And it's a huge event. It was a pretty huge event. I don't really know what the numbers are, but I can at least speak to the fact that they, like you said, had film, video games, whatever else there was. I don't remember the whole list, but the organizers had to do a lot of things, and I can imagine that would have been a very difficult event to organize. So I think there were a lot of learning opportunities for us game developers and the organizers of that event as well. With that being said, it was done very well, I think. And I think it was very distinct in general to PAX. It didn't have the same feel. I think it was targeted not only to a general audience, but also to people in the industry, so to other game developers and to, publishers and that kind of network. So I think that made it also very difficult to organize. So from our perspective, I guess the game developers, it was really cool that they had catered to both sides. And I think half of the days that I was present, or at least I showed the game, because I didn't show the game the whole time South by Southwest Games was active, there would be kind of industry events, talks, by other game developers and people in, like publishers, for instance. And yeah, that was really cool because we got to meet a lot of industry professionals and talk to people and have a lot of learnings on that side. I think that was really well done. And that's something that I guess PAX just doesn't have if we were to compare it to PAX. It may have that. I think it's hard to say because PAX, that's just not necessarily what PAX is strong for. But when I went to Melbourne for Melbourne International Games Week, you know, there are all sorts of other events that do that.
Yes.
Such as GCAP, and that's kind of like the other side of that. So, you know, I would argue having those kind of specific events that really focus on one thing might be a better way to organize things, but who knows? Yeah, I think South by Southwest, it wasn't as strong in terms of the audience presence if you compare to PAX. We met, I think, far more people, who just other game developers, other influencers, which is really important to us and really valuable. But yeah, if I was to look at both of the events and think of what value they had in retrospect, PAX was really great with connecting the audience, our player base, that kind of thing. South by Southwest was other game developers and influencers. I really think that it will improve in the years to come, like I said, because there were a lot of learning experiences to have, and I think they got a lot of feedback, and it was their first year. So I'm excited to see what comes next.
Well, I mean, they're both back on again this year, and I think both, if not even still incredibly close in timing, which I'm sure is going to be continually a logistical challenge for everyone that goes to both. I'm also curious, so I mean, I don't know if this is just a placeholder or if this is already locked in 100%, but I mean, the game is self-publishing, or at least Turtle Flip as a studio, as a company, is self-publishing. You know, cognizant, there's probably a few people who are listening who are maybe thinking about developing games and thinking, how do I release my game? Do I go to a publisher? Do I do it myself? I'm keen to understand if you have any like logic behind why you've gone the self-publishing route versus trying to pitch to a, I don't know, like a Humble or a Devolver or a whoever else is out there trying to pick up these smaller sort of indie game experiences.
Yeah. One aspect of that, I think, is the genre, this genre of game, just through talking to other game developers, is I think that this genre is a little bit trickier to get funding for. I guess the local multiplayer, well, local, lots of things, I think. currently, the demo is local, and we do hope and plan to release with online multiplayer, but it's still, you know, marketed as a party game, effectively, like yes. Mario Party. So it's just a bit trickier to get funding for that, and it's something that's in the cards, and we've had conversations about, and I think. I haven't been pushing as hard as I could have. I can kind of the mind if I can self-publish, then I'd love to. And I'm not necessarily going to continue to do so, or I'm going to finish doing so. So, yeah, that's something that's in development. And so I don't have a great answer for that, to be honest.
Oh, no, but I mean, that's still interesting. I think. Like, it's one of those things that if you, again, particularly if there's a budding, you know, game developer just starting on that journey, I mean, it's very opaque as to like how that system works, right? Like beyond yes. like, I don't know, I'm just going to go try and talk to someone and hope they give me money for my game. And I think that aspect of even learning the genre importance or of how that maybe influences your direction is really interesting.
No, you're right. The thing that I found interesting is that I really did have to learn about that. Actually, I learned a lot from the last Melbourne International Games Week. While I was there, I was just kind of learning about the ins and outs of talking to publishers and pitching to publishers and what is required to communicate to them, and like, you know, how developed does your game need to be, or you know, what genre is more exciting for them. And you know, it's difficult, and I think you really do need to maybe it helps to get into a community where you can learn about other developers who have had success in that regard, and just look at other presentations, like pitch presentations, and understand what works and what doesn't. I don't think, unfortunately, I'm the best person to give advice to because I'm still learning in big part. But yeah, I would say, yeah, just having friends in a community, game developers, is just has been so valuable, and I think will continue to be so.
And that's probably where I was going to ask my next question is, how have you, I mean, obviously, I assume you've always lived and developed games in Australia, but I mean, from your perspective, how have you found it being in, I guess, like Australia, in the Australian scene? Has that been, from your perspective, quite positive? You know, do you feel like there's a lot of good support coming from governments or other parties? Like, you've obviously mentioned the Sydney
Games Week.
And yeah, Sydney. Games Week, yeah. And the what was it, Beers and something? I forgot, I'm blanking on the name. Beers and Pixels. Yeah, I was going to say Beers and Bits, but I was like, it's not Bits. It was close, though. How have you found it? Like, again, just indie game developer in Australia, or even more specifically Sydney, how has that experience been from your view?
I went through a bit of a journey, I suppose, after I graduated, where I did want to get a job in game dev, and it was difficult, especially in Sydney or New South Wales. I'll talk about Sydney because that's where I'm from and that's my experience. I think, and this is kind of my theory that I've kind of come up with, is that New South Wales just doesn't have as good, I guess, government funding as Victoria, as an example, and a number of other states. I think it's potentially one of the worst states in that regard for video game funding. And I think the games and studios that come out, I'll say more, the games, they kind of reflect that. They are more focused on revenue because they need to pay the bills. they have that focus because I think that that's interesting when you consider, I suppose, more of a philosophical game design choices. Like, is it good to have, you know, loot boxes or kind of slot machine type related mechanics in your mobile game? Or, you know, when you're making decisions early on, you know, do we want to, like, if we can apply for this grant, which will, you know, allow us to create a prototype over 6 to 12 months with a small team, then it's kind of like you just, I can imagine that you would feel so much more freedom. And I think that's that kind of creative freedom is evident in a lot of the games that I've seen over the last 5 to 10 years coming out of Victoria. When I go down to PAX in Melbourne, you know, you see that little pink banner at the top often that kind of says, Screen Vic was, you know, funded this game. Then a lot of those games, they're just amazing. And I really respect them. And that's the kind of the game, those are the kinds of games that I'd love to make. That are kind of innovative and interesting, and those are the kinds of things that people expect from indie games. So early on, I was a bit sad about the opportunities in Sydney and how difficult it was, because it was also very competitive, and it still is relatively competitive to get jobs in Sydney in the game dev industry. But I will say that it's getting a lot better, I think, over time. And I think in terms of funding opportunities, Screen Australia has done an amazing job to give those opportunities Australia-wide to people. They've created and designed new-ish grants that have been around for a few years. But when I started, I think they weren't present, basically. And so it basically gives anyone in New South Wales that opportunity to apply for the Screen Australia grants. And I think that's helped a lot. And I think it's just something that's organically grown. There have been a few more kind of game dev and game design colleges that have come up, and I think when I had to decide if I wanted to go to uni, if I wanted to go to a college, what I was going to study at uni, I didn't really have as many choices in terms of game design colleges, and I meet so many people in these game dev communities these days that are just kind of being popped out as being quite ready to go into the game dev industry, who are studying in Sydney. So it's actually, in a very short space of time, you know, like I said, 5 to 10 years, the landscape has changed quite a bit in a very positive way.
Awesome. Do you ever feel like it's more of a struggle being, say, here in Australia than if you were, I don't know, in America with access to way more people, way more events? I don't know about funding. I'm sure it's still incredibly challenging from a government perspective over in America, though I might be wrong. Or is it not something you've really given much thought, given it's you know, picking up and moving to LA is probably not on the cards for many of us, if any of us.
Yeah, definitely. I have thought about it, but not for incredible lengths of time. I considered much more seriously moving to Melbourne. That was a hard enough decision for me just because of my family and friends. I think I'm a little bit more introverted and attached to the friends that I have. And so just the idea of moving to a new city and, you know, creating a network from nothing, at the time at least, was a big step for me. And so it was just easier, I think, to stay here in Sydney. But for sure, I think there are other opportunities. And I do wonder, yeah, about the balance between the competitiveness. If you're in a city with a more booming game dev kind of industry, I think, yeah, I don't know if it makes a huge difference. I think as long as you can kind of, you have events to meet people. I know I keep saying the same thing, but
yeah, no, it's good to reiterate.
I think it's good to hammer home that importance of networking, because I think that rings true whatever career or industry or, well, whatever field you're in. That I think that is always an important factor.
Yeah,
in my opinion, anyway.
And to your own self description there, I imagine there's quite a lot of introverted people who are in this space, and networking isn't necessarily their favorite thing to do. So it's a good reminder. It's A, maybe not as scary as you think it is, particularly when you realize, oh, I'm also networking with a lot of similar people that are going through the same anxieties I am.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. But as well as that, I think a lot of the people that organize these events try to do a really good job at, I guess, creating them so that they're easy for, I guess, more introverted people to enjoy and to find more relaxing. I think that's often through activities, like shared activities. Game jams are so great because you have something to focus on together. It's easy to discuss the specifics of the game you're creating, or playtesting events. People just bring their game, they open their laptop. Even just going to an event, you just have to open your laptop, sit there, and people will come to you, and then they'll give you feedback and you can talk about that. So, like, I think leaning into your introversion in a way can kind of work if you do it the right way.
A couple of things I'm, you know, very fascinated by is, so I mean, only probably was it, I'm going to embarrass myself here, I can't remember if it was like January or around then, but you announced the game is coming out in Q1 2025, and then more recently have made a demo that's just seemingly perpetually up on Steam. I don't know if there's an end date on that at all, but I'm assuming it's just there until you decide it's not. Just keen to understand what was your thought process behind, yep, let's announce the date roughly, say, a year out. It might be a bit longer, might be a bit less, and B, just having a demo up already. And is that, yeah, what was the thought process behind those two decisions?
Yeah, the release date, I think, is kind of a function of what remains to be developed or what we want to develop and our resources and all of that kind of thing. I'd love to release it sooner, but I also want to make as good of a game as possible. We also talked about releasing it around Christmas, or a little bit earlier, like before the end of this year. But yeah, I think I've just kind of been advised and heard from people that that can be tricky to release a game around that time, because there will be so many other game releases to compete with and you really have to stand out. So yeah, it was kind of like a safe option, but we really want to release around the end of the year or at the beginning of next. So that was where that decision came from. I think the demo release, I guess this early on, is a factor of me going to these playtesting events and talking to people and telling them the release date and them kind of having this disappointment, like, oh, I have to wait that long kind of thing. And I kind of just wanted to, I guess, put something out there that people can just, that I can point them to and say, no, well, you don't have to wait that long. You can play it now, effectively. And I don't really see it as a bad thing strategically because, well, it kind of just makes me happy that people would play the game first of all. I want them to experience it. And I think that if they enjoy it and they talk about it, they show their friends, I think that's a great thing. And I'd love for that to happen and for them to kind of maybe build hype, excitement about the game, share it with their friends. And I guess the alternative is that we only have a trailer out or marketing material without the actual game. And I think if the game stands up, which I hope it will and does, then I hope that people will be more convinced by playing it and feeling it. I also think that it's hard to communicate a feeling of a game sometimes without actually playing it, without controlling the characters. And I do think that that's the case with Which Way Up, because of these gravity feelings, it can be really satisfying and hard to describe. So I really just did want to get it into people's hands. Yeah, and so I hope people will be able to enjoy it over the next year and get excited about more mini games. And I guess another factor was that I just want to get as much feedback as I can from people. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to kind of tailor the design, which is just starting to happen now, of the next few mini games, which are not set in stone, based on any suggestions or ideas that people have. You know, if people start playing with some mini game in some unusual way, like they start breaking the game in some way and finding some weird mechanic that I didn't want them to find, then I'll be like, well, I should make a mini game based on that idea that kind of sprang out. So yeah, I guess leaving it open for those opportunities is another factor that I was thinking about.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good idea, particularly as you said, with like a fairly like unique concept. It's, I think that feel aspect does so much compared to the trailer aspect. Not that the trailer, like, I mean, the characters are incredibly cute, so it does have a visual appeal to it straight away. But I agree that playing it is a whole different thing. Like, I remember, because I first played it at PAX, I think it was me and a friend against like these two, maybe like, I don't know, 10-year-old boys, roughly 10 to 8. I don't know, I'm not good with picking people's ages, particularly children. But I just remember like seeing like, you know, how drawn they were, and they just wanted to keep playing it and that kind of stuff. And I think that's a function of the getting your hands on, getting the feel, and then also that like, oh, I want to get better. Like, I can see how I can get better. And they got very good, if I recall it, I think Event Horizon, that's the one where you're running away from the black hole. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, they were always at the front of the screen, where me and like my friend were just like in the middle. They were just like destroying us.
That's a very relatable experience for me as well. My partner and I play the game a little too often, but you know, it's mostly for playtesting purposes, but she beats me at a specific one or two mini games almost every time. And perhaps inappropriately, I'm always saying, this doesn't make sense. I made this game. I should win at everything. Yeah. Stop beating me. But she finds it very satisfying. So I understand that experience. And also, it's actually fun watching kids play as well. I took the game to the Powerhouse in Castle Hill recently. It was this family event. And there are a bunch of kids just filing in and out, playing the whole day. And we just loved watching some of their reactions. Some kids would just pick it up immediately. They just understand a lot of the concepts and the movement. Others would struggle a little bit more. And then the ones that were picking it up and playing, kind of, you know, trying to tell them what to do to get them through the tutorial. But then a lot of these kids just didn't want to kind of take advice. They really wanted to do things on their own, which I just find really funny. I kind of see myself in that. It's like, no, I want to do it myself. And they wouldn't like let anyone take the controller to do it. So there were a few moments where everyone was waiting for, you know, one kid to kind of complete a little skill gate, which was very cute and funny.
Ah, awesome. You've mentioned before, and this is me putting on, you know, interviewer hat, got to try and see what we can get out of you. You know, you've got more ideas for other mini games, and potentially, I imagine you've already started making or have made some of those. But ultimately, more broadly, like sort of what sort of the vision for where you want to see this once it launches, and maybe even post-launch? Do you have sort of like a goal, whether it's on a number of mini games or potentially number of platforms you want to see this kind of land on in the long run, noting that I suspect this will be PC at launch, and that's probably it as the target platform?
We're planning on having as many platforms on launch as we can. It's kind of undecided. The big goal is to have at least two. I won't mention much more about what they are yet. But yeah, I mean, it's designed for a specific platform in mind. And
yeah,
it's more console-based, obviously, because it's quite controller-friendly. So yeah, we'd love to bring it to more consoles, definitely, for release. The other minigame, so we kind of, our goal is to have about 13 in total, 12 or 13. Wow, well, yeah, we were actually talking about this the other day, like the idea of what makes a good minigame, like how do we, through this design process, how do we grade an idea as good? And we came up with a few factors, which I thought you might find interesting, and it's certainly been good for us to kind of get our minds straight. So we kind of decided that a big factor for some of the current minigames that's being fun is replayability is the first thing. Another thing that we really like is describability. So we kind of thought about it in a marketing perspective, like how easy is it for someone to tell their friend, you know, oh, you should try this game. It has, you know, soccer in space. There's a game where you are running away from a black hole, you know, XYZ. So we think that that's actually important, not only for picking up kind of the game while you're playing it, but also just like from a marketing perspective of how do people talk about it to each other and get each other excited about certain aspects of it. Another concept is just, I mean, this one's obvious, general uniqueness. So, you know, there's the core concept of gravity, but we just want to kind of spread the mini games out as much as possible to cover lots of different lenses, like I said before, on looking at that core mechanic. And the last thing, which I think was the most interesting for us, is this concept of jeopardy. So I would, two examples of the mini games that work well with jeopardy that we currently have in the demo are Event Horizon and Overload. So Event Horizon is you're just running away from a black hole, and a black hole slowly moves across the screen, kind of covering more and more of it. And we like that, and we think that people, players like it as well, because it's really easily, it really easily communicates this kind of closing or ensuing danger. And the drama.
It's visually distinct. Yeah.
And the drama ramps up as well. Like people can feel a tenseness growing. And the other one is Overload, where it's essentially a bomb tag in space where one player is overloading and they have to pass this overloading energy to another sprite before they explode. So that kind of beeping before an explosion, as well as all the player lives, kind of creates this jeopardy drama and an obvious kind of feeling of danger. And I think those are the ones that seem to work really well and players respond to in terms of the dramatic moments that they create, and the kind of yells and screams that we see at playtesting event is kind of like a very positive thing and we like to hear. So those are the factors that we are going to be thinking about as we design more and more of these little mini games.
I have to say, Overload's the one that I can't beat my wife. She just always, like, in the last second, like, passes the energy onto me, and I just go, you know, it, she screams in happiness, and I probably say a word that I won't, given this is a family-friendly game that we're interviewing about. That's awesome. With that in mind, I mean, one thing I'm curious, and it's probably maybe not a thought process you've had to go through yet, but you may be in the future. Let's say, you know, you're getting towards launch and you've got, say, that 13th game and you're like, this is good, but it's not quite as good as the others. I mean, have you thought about the decision between this meeting a certain level of what we consider quality, maybe it's those three components and how they measure on a scale that's largely in your head, I suppose, versus but it's still good to have one extra thing in there for more variety. Like, have you thought about how you're going to tackle that?
Yeah, definitely. That I've thought about that, and we've thought about that a lot with already with the games that we've had. So we actually have had another mini game that has not made the cut already. I would describe it as a kind of like a checkpoint racing mini game. So there were just these little checkpoints that appear on planets. They kind of open up, and every player has to go to their checkpoint. Had to go to their checkpoint, and then once they get through, another checkpoint would open up. And so you're kind of just, it's just a race through a space which could be somewhat randomized by when and how, in what order we open the checkpoints. It didn't really, I found that it didn't really make much sense for a multiplayer game. First of all, was a big reason I didn't like it. In fact, I wanted to kind of make that a factor that I mentioned recently about, you know, Jeopardy and replayability. Like, yes. Does this mini game make sense as a multiplayer game? Or we could ask the question, is this just a single player game where everyone's playing the single player game at the same time in the same world? And I think that previous example was that. And so, it's a really great question. And it's also at odds with another factor, which is that some people are better at certain mini games than other people. So I really love that aspect of the game that, you know, people, some players will just have this favorite game and they'll always beat you in this favorite game. And I really think that that's a good wide audience potential thing, that someone can take something out of it. And that's a nice edge. And so I really would like to focus on uniqueness, and it gets harder and harder to design mini games. The more mini games we have, we've kind of found that some mini game designs are almost inevitable, like they're obvious. So one of these designs that's going to come up, one of our next mini games, we've had recommended or suggested by two or three separate people who just don't know each other, and they just suggested the exact same thing. And so it's like, oh, okay. Well, that's
something serendipity.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like an inevitability. It's almost like, well, it has to happen. It must be so obvious that we can't not have it. And so I hope that we can find those kind of theoretical things that were always and should always have been designed and create those. And then I suspect there will be a few which aren't as good, but we'll just try to, you know, squeeze the fun out of them as much as we can. And I don't expect all mini games will be, you know, the exact same level of quality, if one could even measure that, based on what we just said, that people prefer other mini games, some mini games over others. So yeah, it's a tricky one. And it's just a case by case basis, I think.
No, it's fascinating to hear you break down mini game design and the different your approach and how you have I won't say formula, but you have some guidelines to help you shape them, because you mentioned it very briefly earlier, but Mario Party comes to mind, of course, when people talk about mini games. And I think the discourse around Mario Party is often, oh, the earlier ones are better, and people will always pick out their favorite mini games. And it seems to me anyway that the mini games people identify in Mario Party that they love and are the memorable ones, that even 20 years after the fact of Mario Party 1 and 2 that they remember, are the ones that you are interacting with other players. There's something at stake, and it isn't just everyone's playing a single player game, that there is that competitive element to it and there's that interactivity to it. So I guess to try to make that more of a question than a statement, I know you, of course, for Which Way Up, there are distinct mechanics, the gravity that is informing all the minigame designs, but has there been an element of recalling back other games that use minigames as a gameplay mechanic? Or I guess, of course, I'm a PhD researcher, as some of our listeners know. Do you sometimes research other games and think, oh, how did another game handle a particular gameplay element or build a mini game around an idea? Can we borrow, or can we be inspired or influenced by that to craft it? Or if you have an idea but it's not quite working, is there ways that you workshop that idea to try to make it work and try to make it hit the goals that you're the milestone that you think that if it hits that milestone, it's good enough to be in the game?
Yeah, definitely. We had a phase where we just played a bunch of Fall Guys, for instance. I think, that's a big inspiration. And I think one of the mini games is very heavily inspired by, or I'll say inspired by one of the mini games in Fall Guys. which is just staying inside this ring, which moves around a map. And I don't think that's anything new. That's kind of like a, you know, a sort of capture the flag variation or King of a Hill variation. And again, I think that was, that's something that kind of had to happen. It was inevitable that I thought that it is an interesting concept or feel that it's good to have all the players trying to be in a really tight space at the same time to kind of just see what happens. And I think it works to create this unique feel and experience in a mini game. So yeah, I really love kind of looking at these other games and just and trying to be inspired by them and see if they would make sense in space. I guess. Yeah. Yeah, I've had similar experiences like with, you know, Mario Party. And for me, one of the more nostalgic ones is Pokemon Stadium on the 64.
Oh, yeah.
Had this mini game area. I used to love those for some reason. Like, and with just mini games, games that have mini games, you always have your favorites and ones that are just more nostalgic. And I, for sure, I remember a bunch of those, which are, they just sit, have a really fond kind of space in my brain, which the other ones I kind of don't remember at all. And it's funny that these games, they put so much work into making, you know, 12, and depending on the game, I guess Mario Party, they would have close to maybe 100 mini games or Fall Guys as well, but you know, some of the crowd favorites, people will remember one or two, and that's a really interesting aspect of designing mini game, I guess, video games. So yeah, that it's really hard. And I went through this process actually where I didn't like comparing our game to Mario Party, because there are some mini games in Mario Party. I think you maybe even described it that way, where you're kind of just spamming A and B or something, like A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B. And I don't really think, it's almost like using the word minigame can be a bit of a disservice sometimes, because people can associate minigames to that. And I don't really see our games, our minigames, as that. And so the language in our game is actually, we say that they are events or space events.
Yes.
That makes sense. Yeah.
But in development, we often, we say mini games. And when I talk to people, it's mini games. But yeah, the language, I think it has these connotations where it's like, oh, it feels like they didn't take that much work to implement. Because when I look at Mario Party, it's like spamming AB to get a character to kind of animate up and down as fast as possible. And a progress bar to go up. It's not necessarily as involved as our process.
No.
And yeah, we're not looking to create 50 to 100 mini games. And I think if we did try to, they would lose their quality, their maybe uniqueness, how difficult it is to pick them up. Because I want people to maybe develop favorites, to know what they all do, to learn them every time. Maybe if they play it, you know, once a month, they'll be able to pick it up without having to relearn things. So yeah, it's an interesting comparison to other games.
And I think you're right. It is something that's so, like, the language there is so important, because you're right. Like, I mean, you'd probably call these more like, if mini is the wrong term, it's probably more like small or medium or something. You know what I mean? If we're getting more specific.
It's like a compilation of different game cards, game modes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is a weird tangent. It often makes me think of, we're big Nintendo heads, just if that wasn't already obvious, but like, I'm a big fan of WarioWare.
You're wearing the shirt.
Yeah, it's Mario Day. I've got to wear a Mario shirt on Mario Day. I like WarioWare a lot, and they use the term micro games, again, very intentionally, I think, because they're even smaller than Mario Party, right? But then they did like another one on Wii U, which was closer to your game. It was like maybe like six, not even, you know, as many games as yours, but longer form, small games. And they just like, oh, we've got to not call it WarioWare. We've got to call it something else. I think they called it Game and Wario or whatever. I think it's interesting to see how, like, even at, like, again, Nintendo, they think very carefully around branding and naming of these kinds of things and how that impacts people's views. So it's just interesting to see that's a similar conclusion you've come to. I love these kinds of games, and I think they're so underappreciated in, like, the broader, like, you don't see, like, Boomerang Foo at a, you know, Jeff Keighley's Game Awards, even though it probably should be, you know, like, that's the kind of thing, like, I always find fascinating. But luckily, the market at least responds, and I think games like that can be very successful. So at least there's a bit of a disconnect between the Game Award scene versus what people are actually buying and playing.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, that was more of a statement, but still.
No, that's very interesting. And obviously, I agree. I think that it's really hard to communicate the value of, especially if you're including multiple little games. And that's something we've thought about heaps, obviously. Like, I don't know if you guys remember, but we have a little game before you start the match of selecting, being able to select mini games. And that screen has gone through so much design iteration, and I'm still very unhappy with it. I'd love to kind of, we've thought about kind of voting on different mini games that people want to play. I found that it really doesn't work very well at conventions and kiosks and playtesting events because people are just jumping in to play a game once. They want to play it once and they want to leave. But I think for replayability, I really want to kind of emphasize that so that people can kind of create slightly different narratives that they will experience through playing against each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love the idea of just saying, oh, let's just do a round where we only play, you know, the soccer Comet Collect game, or let's only run away from a black hole, or let's kind of do these two, or let's do like everyone choose their favorite that they always win at, or something like that. I hope that that's kind of a thing that will emerge, but like I said, it's kind of it is important for me to kind of us to think about how that game, that that screen is going to be designed to try to encourage that as much as possible.
Yeah, it feels very much like a, like almost like a playlist. Like sometimes one day you're like a same song on repeat 100 times, another day it's listen a whole album, and other times it's just shuffle and see what pops up. So that's interesting. Very good.
One of my last questions, and you've touched on it, but and it's I think it's a theme throughout our discussion today, has been regarding feedback. And of course, I think you've been quite open to receiving feedback. You're doing all the conventions, you have an active Discord, even with the I guess the subtitle of the game, you're currently asking opinions on what people think a suitable subtitle for the game to follow, which way up will be, I guess. But and I think it's very important for any budding game developers or anyone working on a project to take feedback. But how do you, I guess, design mechanisms to make sure that you're synthesizing that feedback? And because, of course, feedback is often going to be contradictory. You're never going to receive a clear funnel of feedback of, oh, do this, do that, and then do this final point and you'll have the perfect product. And then you'll nod and say, oh, perfect, I'll go away and do that, work on that, and then I'll have the best game that can ever be out there. Feedback doesn't quite work like that, but of course it's vital to the process. So if you're able to, I guess, expand a bit on what your process around getting the most out of feedback is, and I guess not being caught in a feedback loop where you're trying to, I guess, keep on chasing after fulfilling what people are telling you that they have suggestions of, but might not actually help the project and the game in the end of the day.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's very difficult. I would say that, yeah, it's just a big journey and learning experience, just figuring out what feedback is good, what to listen to. And I guess it will be your radar or your compass for that. It's probably particular to every game that you work on, I would imagine. But I would say, firstly, you probably need to consider who you're getting feedback from. Obviously, going to playtesting events, you'd largely get feedback from developers or game designers, but they're not, you know, all the same person. There will be artists, there will be programmers, there'll be game designers, you know, and they all have such, you know, they're not all the same person. Not all every archetype is the same person, yes. But, you know, they tend to lean towards focusing on different things, obviously. So you'll get drastically different feedback from each, and it's all very interesting. But yeah, I guess people that are able to kind of think of the game, I think, from an audience's and a player's perspective and give feedback based on that, I think can give the most valuable feedback to you, like directly, for you to consider directly. But if someone is perhaps giving feedback just from their own experiences, which is what happens most of the time, then you really have to consider their perspective and compare it to everything else that you know about the game and everyone else's feedback. So when that happens, an example I already gave is people saying, you know, I don't know, can you introduce a shield, for instance, so that you can block people comet pushing you.
Mm.
And if I was to get that feedback, then I might say, well, how many times have I received that feedback? I guess, first of all, have 10 people given me that feedback? Maybe it's something I need to consider seriously. But then, you know, if it passes that test, then I think, you know, like, will it actually stand up to all these other design pillars that I have? So I think that's something really important that I think I learned from a God of War game designer talk that I went to at some stage. They talked about how they had these three design pillars throughout the whole project. And I can't remember exactly what they were. It was something like exploration, combat, something else. Yeah, I can't remember. But the fact was that, like, every decision that they made, they needed to kind of relate that decision back to that. Like, does this feedback, does this design decision actually make one of these things better and not make any one of them worse? Or is it some other kind of concept that we're trying to introduce and we're introducing too much complexity? So for me and for our game, I think it's really, like I said, the two factors that are at odds with each other of keeping it approachable, but also trying to provide a high skill ceiling. And so I often, it's always just that those are the questions I ask myself. Like, how much am I benefiting from one of those pillars if I take this feedback and implement it? And then how much will it detract from the other one? And if they, you know, both kind of like the net improvement of both of them kind of is a nice value, qualitatively at least, then I'll really strongly consider it. But yeah, it's very difficult. And I think more and more, I'm kind of just trying to stick close to our values, because early on I was taking a lot of feedback, and I'm still very open to a lot of people's thoughts. But it gets harder and harder to make changes the further into development we are, especially yes. to core mechanics. But I'd love to improve all of the mini games that are already out. I think that in my mind they're definitely not finished. I want to make everything feel a lot better. I want to add little things that some people might not notice, but I noticed certain things, like Comet Collect, for instance. All of your interactions with the little comet soccer ball that's in the map, I would love that to be improved, so it's easier to kind of interact with and so that it's a bit more fun. So just before the demo, for instance, I introduced the ability for the soccer ball to kind of bounce on a player's head if they are on the ground, whereas previously it would skim past. You're going to say something?
Oh, awesome.
Oh, yeah.
I just thought that's a good idea.
There are a lot of tiny little improvements. And if for instance, that if Comet Collect was the whole game, then those are the things that we would do on a day-to-day basis, is like look at little edge cases. Mm. Like, oh, well, what will happen if, you know, the ball is traveling at high velocity and the player just jumped at it at a decent velocity? Like, will they bounce off each other? Will the player stick to the comet? There are a lot of little edge cases in all of the games. Some have more than others, but all those things culminate to, you know, the experience feeling more or less fun, memorable, and exciting. So we're always kind of, what's it called, juggling plates, trying all the mini games and saying, oh, which one yes. feels least fun at the moment? Let's work on that. Or do we need to make the next six plates start spinning? And then, you know, once we do, we'll come back to all the other ones, make them as good as we can.
So during the course of the development, whether it was, you know, at the start or whenever it may have been, was there a particular, like, one hurdle that, or one key challenge that you had to overcome that made this effectively work? And you're like, yep, now this is a viable project. I can make this game. It's going to succeed.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed prototyping all the gravity mechanics. And that was one of the more difficult parts. And I lent on a few of my game dev friends and asked them various questions, like, have you implemented gravity before? How did you do it? Because, I, for instance, I kept having this problem where I had kind of created these gravity fields. So the whole game engine is made up of different shaped gravity fields. So one of the standard basic ones is just a circle, all of the gravity kind of points towards a center, kind of like the core of a planet. Another one might be just a straight gravity field. Another one might just be an arc, so like the rounded corner of a box or something like that. But the thing that I found tricky, we had implemented gravity, so the players were falling in the right direction. But when they were actually running on the surface of a planet, if they were to go around a tight corner, often they would be running so fast that they would just kind of fall off the edge. I guess it's kind of just like imagining a really huge giant running on planet Earth, and they kind of running at great speed. Suddenly they can just accelerate super fast, and gravity is not that strong to keep them on. So like, the game doesn't really make sense physics-wise. So we had to kind of implement a system to get them to stick to the floor. So they're either going in a grounded state, like they are sticking, they're on the ground, or they're not. So as you turn around, it will keep kind of detecting gravity and continually stick you to the floor, like plant you down. So constantly the player is actually falling off the edge of the planets, and then they're kind of like being magnetized on every frame. I found that very funny to do, and it's actually a constant problem when implementing other mechanics, because this sticky force is always there. And so if we want to do things like kicking a bomb, like if the player runs into a bomb and tries to kick it off another planet, then we have to kind of negate the force of stickiness at that moment. And so that's definitely one of the challenges, that once I figured that out, everything started to feel fun and be a bit more possible. That was a fun aspect, and I still struggle with implementing new mechanics based on that little dynamic. So,
all righty. Before we end up, I do have one last question for both of you, actually, Brendan. Again, I've done this to you a few times in more interview ones where I turn it on you as well. You've got a slew of great little cute characters that everyone can play as. Who's your favorite?
I think it's hard to pick. Honestly, I love just changing between the different characters. I think they all have their different personalities.
I did notice on the Discord you chose Sprout, Brendan. Was there a reason behind Sprout, or was that just because it's green?
Because it's green and I like plants, so that's why I did choose Sprout in the Discord. So
yeah,
I think that's a viable reason, right?
Yeah,
I think it is valid. It's a popular choice as well, it seems. I think a lot of people just like Sprout, and it's my favorite character as well. I have fallen into the trap of choosing the same character all the time when I play. So if someone chooses Sprout and I have to choose another character, I'm constantly getting confused. I keep thinking that I'm Sprout, so I think I need to branch out.
That makes sense, because I noticed, at least in the key art, Sprout and I think Prism are the two sort of most prominent characters for sure. So and certainly Sprout at the forefront, so it makes sense that the bias is showing. I'll be different. I like them all, but I do like Sunny a lot, just because I'm a big yellow person and I like brightness. And so Sunny, you know, speaks to me on that level quite well. Though I have to say Prism was also up there, just because, again, that's similar. I just like the triangular sort of vibe to them going on. So, you know, and I'm sure, you know, whenever you check out the demo or play the game, all our listeners will find themselves in a heated debate over there. Which one's their favorite character, which, speaking of, is a good time to start plugging things away. So as we've mentioned, you know, Which Way Up is got a demo on Steam, and you should certainly go check that out, wishlist it, follow the game on Twitter, etc. I'm going to throw it though to you, Nick, to do your however you want to plug it, and what's the, you know, if there was one key thing you want someone to do after listening to this, what is it?
Yeah, thanks, Zach. Yeah, if anyone would love to check it out, I would recommend jumping on Steam and downloading the demo. Look forward to a few more platforms coming on our release. You can actually play online with Steam Remote Play together. I would say that the caveat to that is that you do need a strong internet connection, and it helps to be geographically in a similar location. That's just kind of a pitfall of Steam Remote Play. We do want to and plan to implement online multiplayer into the game on release. So hopefully you'll be able to play with friends across the world and in different locations when we do. So, but yeah, demo on Steam, and if you can wishlist it, it would really help us out. It's really great for the algorithm and our game being more visible there, and we just want to get as many people playing the game and giving feedback and suggestions as we can. Thanks, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on
and sharing all your story and everything about Which Way Up and what you're currently working on. It's been fantastic.
That's my pleasure. It was really fun talking about it.
And I'm looking forward to it. Can't wait to see the full version. Though luckily the demo is there to keep me satiated for those many months. And, you know, while I go and maybe go start playing another round with my wife, Brendan, do you want to plug our own podcast, which people are listening to, and where they can find us, reach out to us, and, you know, hey, if there's any game developers out there that also want to talk to us about their game, happy to hear from you. So, yeah, Brendan, do you want to tell them where they can reach out to us?
Of course. As always, we have our email address, which is blowingcartridge@gmail.com. We're on Twitter/X at BlowCartPod, also on Facebook, also on Blue Sky, and you can find myself at Tamazoid on those social medias. Zach is either at Eggerino or at Egmond, and all these social media handles and emails will be in the show notes of this episode, and we'll also add Nick's and his studio's social media tags and all that. So I think that's sort of the place to go to find out all that information. And as always, well, review our podcast, rate it on any podcast service you might use, and every review always helps us get more visibility and get up on the charts of various podcasting services. So that's always the best way to help us if you're a long time suffering supporter of our podcast.
Yeah, reviewing podcasts is like the wish listing of upcoming games on Steam. The two key metrics that algorithms seem to care about. So if you can do both for Which Way Up and then for review us, that'd be fantastic. But yeah, thank you both again for this interesting chat. As I said, I'm going to go play some more Which Way Up now, so I'm going to get off the call soon. But thank you again for the conversation.
Thanks so much, guys. It's really fun.
Thank you, and best of luck for the rest of the development.
Cheers.